Welcome to Politico Money. I'm Ben White. Politico is hosting live conversations with lawmakers and business leaders virtually. For the conventions, we've got a special set of shows for you. A conversation with economic advisors from the Democratic Party for the DNC this week, and a similar conversation with economic advisors from the Trump administration for the RNC next week. And I'm joined today by a full panel. Congressman Don Beyer is a Democrat from Virginia and vice chair of the Joint Economic Committee. Jared Bernstein is former chief economic advisor to Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden, and he's also a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Heidi Shierholz is senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute and a former chief Department of Labor economist under the Obama administration. Here's our conversation.
All right, so let's jump in. Jared, I wanted to start with you. Let's say Biden wins in November. His lead holds up. He beats President Trump and goes on to the presidency. What are the first economic policies he will push for to boost growth and reduce unemployment? And how big of a stimulus package would he go for?
Well, before I answer that, let me just say thank you so much for inviting me and just say it's a pleasure to be here with Heidi. Heidi Shierholz is someone that I was instrumental in hiring at the Economic Policy Institute. And all I can say is that the interview was pretty awkward because after about 30 seconds, I was begging her to come work for us. And Don Beyer is my congressman, and I couldn't be more pleased about that. And I don't know how many people are saying that these days. I start every day learning from Ben White, so that's also a reason I'm happy to be here. Part of the answer to the question is kind of a wonky economics one, which is it depends on the size of the output gap when Biden hopefully puts his hand on a Bible in January. The output gap is the difference between what GDP would be if the economy were operating at full speed and what it is. Or you could think about it as the unemployment gap. How high will unemployment be? But your question is well taken, and I'm not saying that it's not going to be a problem, because every forecast I've seen, including my own, suggests that the output gap, the unemployment rate, will be very high at the beginning of next year. That relates, of course, to the just epic fail of the Trump administration to manage the virus. And as the virus has resurged, we've seen the economic statistics coming in at a slower pace. And so the economy is slowing and is even, I think, threatening a stall if the next fiscal package doesn't quickly get out there. Right. So the magnitude of the package will have to be determined based on conditions.
Yeah, well, let's say, Jared, let's say there isn't one passed, that, and we'll get to the Congressman Beyer on this question, but let's just, for the sake of argument, assume that we don't get another big stimulus and he comes into office needing one.
So I'm not going to give a number in terms of trillions, but it would need to be, you know, definitely very significant in the spirit of the magnitudes of the bills we've seen so far. What I will talk about briefly is Biden's preferences, which he's been, very clear about. First of all, if you don't get control of the virus, there is no sustainable recovery to be had. I mean, that is a fundamental truth that should embed anybody's thinking on economic policy right now. So step one is you have to start getting control of the virus, and that involves listening to physicians, listening to epidemiologists, and implementing plans that he's articulated, and I think probably all of our listeners are familiar with, making sure people have protective equipment, testing, tracing. Biden has proposed a 100,000 public health corps, person public health corps, to help administer these ideas, so kind of a job creation as well as a virus control measure. And then he's talked about the importance of enhanced unemployment benefits, of state and local fiscal relief. Lately, Kamala Harris has been talking about this as well, the potential eviction crisis we're looking at. There's been a little bit of that in the bill so far, but there needs to be a lot more. The HEROES Act passed by the Congress actually had a robust package in that regard. Those are some of the kinds of measures I'd expect us to pursue.
Yeah, we're going to move on from Jared in just a second, but I want to follow up with one thing that was brought up in my column this morning, and I've been thinking a little bit about, and that is the extent to which President Biden would feel pressured to raise taxes, particularly on the wealthy, to address, we do have massive debt and deficit. I know it's not fashionable to care about those, or particularly not to care about those as we're fighting a pandemic. But you know, as Bill Clinton did in 1993, raise taxes on the wealthy to deal with the budget situation. Do you think Joe Biden is likely to push for increases taxes on the wealthy at some point in the first year of his term?
I think it's going to be very dependent on economic conditions. We've talked a little bit about what those conditions might look like. I mean, I think the there are kind of competing impulses there. One is the very strong Keynesian impulse, and you don't offset your deficit spending in the Keynesian context, or you kind of undermine the purpose of it. However, Biden is extremely committed to pay-fors for his permanent initiatives. And if we get a chance, we should talk about them. Those are the Building Back Better ideas that don't just get us back to where we were, but restore a much more resilient economy on the other side of this. Those sorts of lasting measures, I think it would be fiscally reckless not to pay for those. And he has a pay for agenda for that. But anything that's a relief package or in the spirit of fiscal relief or stimulus, that typically is deficit financed.
Yeah, sure. I just wonder if you notice the kind of dollar movements and the buying and selling of treasuries, some net sellers of treasuries. It just seems like there's at least the early signals that the market cares a little about the size of our debt and deficit when it hasn't for a long time. But we can come back to that. Congressman,
I do hope we come back to that, because I think the issue of debt and deficits really needs some discussion by a group like this.
Yeah, well, hopefully we can get to it in a brief time. Congressman Beyer, I wanted to ask you about hopes for a stimulus package between now and the election. Obviously, talks have broken down and are nowhere at the moment, but there's some thought that once Republicans are done with their convention and Republicans see that maybe they do need to do something between now and the election, tell us a little bit about what you think of the likelihood of getting another stimulus is between now and then, and when it might happen and how big it might be.
Well, Ben, there doesn't seem to be any movement yet, but I still am very hopeful that Republicans are not going to want to go into this November election without doing something for all the unemployed, for the people that have really been hurt by the recession, and for state and local governments, because all the Republican senators also represent state and local governments who've been hammered. There's one thing in your column this morning about how if you don't get the extra $500 billion of input into the economy through unemployment insurance, through direct checks, that it could have a 4 or 5% impact on the unemployment rate, a 4 or 5% negative impact on GDP growth. Those are things that I think have to touch my Republican friends. Democrats are willing to go on both sides, and Nancy Pelosi's made it abundantly clear she's willing to compromise. And she took $1.5 trillion off of her initial thing right away, saying, please come back to the table.
Right.
But if we don't, we're going to be in so many American workers who are not only going to lose the $600 bump, which they did August 1st, but many of them are getting to the end of their 26-week state unemployment, and there are going to be no way to put food on the table or pay rent.
Right, right. And obviously, state and local has always been the big holdup with the president saying he doesn't want to bail out Democrat states. Is that still the big issue, the amount of money that the federal government might send to state and local governments to help them through these incredible budget shortfalls?
Part of it's state and local, and the amount of money they have for the unemployed is still very minimal. And sadly, the amount of money for children, which, of course, Speaker Pelosi makes the centerpiece. And our HEROES Act, we had $75 billion. And their initial offer, they had $250,000, which is, I think, a 3,000-to-1 ratio.
Right.
We have all these children that are hungry across the country that we need to who are dependent largely on schools to be fed. And that's got to be re-upped, too.
Yeah. Yep. Heidi, okay, let's talk a little bit about what the workforce is going to look like after COVID, assuming we do get to a post-COVID world, which I certainly hope we do. One question I wanted to ask you, and this is probably be something that the Biden administration will focus on, and maybe we'll hear from the vice president tonight, and we heard some from Senator Harris last night, is, you know, what can the federal government do to address racial income gaps as we try to recover from this crisis? And what would a Biden administration do on that to kind of close these gaps in income between, racial groups?
It's a really good question. We have enormous disparities by race in our economy. One key thing is actually getting back to full recovery in the economy will be the most important thing in the first order to reduce racial income gaps. Black and brown workers and families and communities get hit much, much harder by recessions due to things like being disproportionately concentrated in jobs that are hit by the recession due to occupational segregation, discrimination, other kinds of disparities by race. It just means Black and brown communities face this, are hit much harder. So if we do the kinds of fiscal stimulus to help get us back on the road to the to recovery, what others were talking about, extending UI payments, aid to state and local governments, those kinds of things, like indirectly, but also very directly, will actually reduce racial wage gaps. And then on the other side of that, once we do get back to recovery, or these can work on parallel tracks, some of the things we need to do to make sure that we can reduce racial wage gaps are things like strengthening labor standards. They have a massively disproportionate impact on Black and brown workers. Making sure that workers who want to join a union are able to join a union. We know that unionization reduces racial wage gaps because Black workers, for example, are more likely to be in a union. And when they are in a union, they get a bigger boost than other workers. And so unionization actually reduces racial wage gaps. So taking measures to increase unionization will be a really important part of reducing the racial wage gap. And the Biden administration is definitely on board with some really transformative labor law reform that would lead to those kinds of changes.
Got you. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, among others, but we talked a lot before COVID happened about the need to reskill the American workforce and that there was a mismatch between jobs and skills. And there was some pushback, and maybe that wasn't really the case. But at least post-COVID, it's pretty clear that there are a large number of jobs that are not coming back, whether in, you know, retail or travel or wherever else, that are just gone and gone for good. And they're going to need to be a lot of people who get skills for new jobs post-COVID. What's the Biden administration going to do about that?
This is a really interesting question. Usually during recessions, we always hear people say, oh, these jobs are never coming back. And I'm the person saying, no, people, they are coming back. It's an aggregate demand problem. The jobs that come back will look pretty much like the ones that were lost. That's not necessarily the case here, or at least not until we get a vaccine or an effective treatment, because until that time, jobs that involve a lot of social contact, restaurant jobs, tourism jobs, public personal services, events, they're going to be really depressed. So we really do need to think about shifting people into other work. This is not about coding camps. This is going to be about looking at unmet huge national priorities and making huge investments there. And that will get people into productive work, meeting national needs. And so there's a great deal of things that the Biden administration or the Biden campaign is proposing, things like big investments in climate crisis mitigation, big investments in care work, both elder care and child care, big investments in public health. Those kinds of things will both meet national needs and help get people who, you know, were in jobs that involved a lot of social contract to doing other work that's actually good for them, good for our economy, good for our country.
Gotcha. Jared, let me come back to you. And I want to ask you about the stock market, which has done amazingly well since bottoming out in March. We're now back above, the pre-COVID level for the NASDAQ and the S&P. I think the Dow is pretty close. Obviously, yep. The White House is touting that. Vice President Pence touted that. I know the stock market is not the economy. I know not everybody owns stock, and it's not something that benefits all Americans. But I wonder, is the stock market telling us that, hey, maybe things are going to be all right and the future looks great? What do you think about that? And what is the answer?
Great question. Really important question. If the stock market is telling, quote, us that everything's going to be all right, you know, it's wrong. But I don't think it's telling us that. I think it's telling a pretty narrow slice at the top of the scale, that kind of message, like, don't worry, you're going to be fine if there's not a fiscal relief package, because you don't depend on these kinds of measures to reach you. So let me give our audience, I know you know these numbers, just a few numbers. So 80% 80% of the value of the stock market is held by the top 10%, and the bottom half owns virtually nothing in terms of the stock market. So one of the reasons I think your question is so important, so germane, is that what we're seeing now is a glaringly clear microcosm of the inherent inequalities that are built into this economy. And the threat is that absent the kinds of ideas we've started to talk about, and ones that I feel strongly are embedded in the Biden agenda, absent that kind of a real shift in our policy architecture, this is going to be a tale of two recoveries, where the top moves along with the stock market in ways that you've described, and you know, everybody else is either barely getting by or really not getting by. So as the stock market was hitting peaks the day before yesterday, you also had a peak in delinquencies on FHA mortgages. You had peaks or near peaks in hunger, in rent, in the threat of evictions. We know we're looking at a highly elevated unemployment rate. And as I mentioned earlier, the pace of job gains is actually slowing. You said correctly yourself that this morning the unemployment claims actually ticked up a bit. So I am particularly concerned, and this is in the spirit of Congressman Byers' comments, that absent a fiscal relief package, both, quote, micro and macro of the bottom, say, half will really suffer. Micro in terms of families not being able to make ends meet, macro in terms of those folks not having the buying power they need to fuel further economic growth. And this is disproportionately a problem for persons and communities of color.
Right, right. It's interesting to me that the stock market seems to think that we're doing so well. And we should note that a lot of it is driven by big tech that has benefited to some degree from all of us being stuck in our homes and doing these things over Zoom and watching Netflix and Amazon all the time. And the rest of it, it's not that broad of a market.
Yeah, I think there is a rational explanation for some of what's going on. And you just said that there are some big companies who do very well in a quarantine pandemic. Big businesses are gaining market share on small businesses, which I think is actually problematic for the long run. But then there's this big chunk of optimism that, it may be more ebullience or wishful thinking than reality.
Right. And also $3 trillion from the Fed doesn't hurt. Congressman Beyer, I wanted to ask you, Senator Harris said in her speech last night that a Biden-Harris administration would bring back critical supply chains. So the future is made in America. This is obviously part of an effort to, pull some of the blue collar voters away from Trump and union voters who went there the last time around. So how would the Biden administration do that? And are we talking about a U.S. industrial policy?
Well, it moves in that direction because a lot of the things she talked about and Joe Biden's talked about in his economic platform have that flavor. For example, he's talking about $700 billion of annual federal spending that would be done with American businesses and American companies. The whole notion of if the federal government spends all this money, we shouldn't be spending it overseas. He's talked about tripling the manufacturer extension program, especially for small manufacturers and for women-owned and minority-owned manufacturers. And looking in the supply chain thing for bringing back so many of the things that we've been building or buying from overseas to be thinking strategically about how we set them up here. But it's a big challenge. And of course, to build on Heidi's comments, he would want to do all of this in a way that allows for people to join unions. And nobody's forced to do it, but that it's a lot less union hostile than what we have been for the last few years.
Right. Yeah.
And Heidi's comment on the racial injustices and racial inequities by making the child tax credit refundable. It lifts something like 28% of kids out of poverty. It's a huge thing for racial equity. And then expanding the earned income tax credit to the childless workers, once again, and making it refundable, overcomes that disparity between Black and white in really important ways.
Right. Heidi, let me ask you a little bit about that. I mean, Vice President Biden historically has a pretty pro-free trade record. He was obviously for the Trans-Pacific Partnership during the Obama administration, has since said that, he still sort of likes the idea, but would want changes to it. How do you think the trade policy is going to look in the Biden administration that's different from the Trump approach?
So that's a very good question. And I should actually let Jared probably answer some more of that because he's more of an expert on it than I am. But the Trump administration has just been this total ad hoc, give favors to people that were nice to you the night before and vice versa. So it's just been a really incoherent process. And I think the Biden administration, or I know that a Biden administration would just have a very coherent, well thought through approach to trade, and with a really eye towards worker power, towards making sure that the balance of power, which some trade policy really can interrupt to the detriment of workers, is sort of kept in balance as much as possible.
Right. Yeah. Well, Jared, I'll let you speak to that a little bit. I mean, is he going to go back to TPP being a good thing, or is he going to roll back all the Trump tariffs from day one? What does he do?
So let me start by making an observation that I think will resonate with you, Ben, but if it doesn't, you'll tell me. That's that there are a number of areas where I think that, and Don would know this probably better than me, he's in the caucus. There are a number of areas, I believe, where the Democratic views, the views of the kind of Democratic caucus, have moved. I think you'd call it left. I'm not even. Yeah. But those areas include unions, minimum wages, debt and deficits, healthcare, and trade. And by that I mean there is a kind of a rejection among, I think, the broad caucus of kind of a set of economic rules, which were always, in many cases, wrong, by the way, in each of those areas. And I think it's a kind of an enlightening process that I, for one, am happy to see. I know folks like Heidi in the Economic Policy Institute have been pushing in this direction for a long time. And I think that many of the politicians have caught up with these realities. And trade is one of those areas. So to get a bit more specific, I would characterize the approach to trade that Biden has expressed in his many pieces that you'll find on his website. There are 45 of them. Of having kind of three parts. One is working in coalition with partners. Okay, this is not a trade deal, a TPP, or a whatever. It's working in coalition with partners to put pressure on China and other bad actors to do the right thing. So that's one. And Biden has a long history of doing that, and Trump has a long history of screwing that up. Mm. Two would be getting exchange rates right. That is, making sure that we take hard and fast steps against countries that manipulate or manage their currency in order to get an unfair edge in prices. And three, and this is the biggest one and the most important one, and it has to do with domestic investment, not external investment, domestic investment. One of the most critical parts is changing the tax code to disincentivize offshoring, sure, which the Trump tax cut quite massively incentivizes offshoring of jobs. But it's also the kinds of, and I think Don raised this earlier, both in the clean energy, the manufacturing, the procurement, the onshoring, the Buy America plans. In every one of those plans, you have deep domestic investment. And to me, that is a recipe for fair trade that doesn't dampen trade flows, which are useful, but puts the American worker in the driver's seat.
Gotcha. Congressman Beyer, I mean, should President Biden just get rid of all Trump's tariffs as soon as he takes office?
Yeah. Well, if it were I would, but I don't think President Biden will do that.
Why not? He
will recognize, he recognizes that these tariffs are a tax on the American people. Mm-hmm. And that when you tariff one good, you somebody benefits, but some other American is hurt by it. And I think Jared makes the interesting point that the Democratic caucus has moved left on so many things, including trade, but they've also moved back a little bit to the center because of Trump. Right. I find the caucus doesn't like tariffs, and that the TPP, which everyone abandoned early, but right, which Joe Biden was for, 85% of that ended up in the USMCA.
Yeah, sure.
And with the best environmental protections and the best labor protections that we've ever had in a trade agreement. And that becomes the new minimum standard for how we approach both the environment and unionization and trade agreements to come.
Gotcha.
Let me just say, so we can have a little internal debate, is there was some very bad stuff in the TPP that did not end up in the MCA.
So I want to be clear. That was the other 15%.
that they jettisoned.
But pulling out ISDS and things like that,
you end up
with something that everyone can agree to.
There's more union power, there are more labor standards, rules of origin. I thought it was a much better deal, but but that's a different discussion.
Gotcha. And we're not going to get into ISDS in these discussions since we only have a few minutes left. And it's, I mean, it's a very important topic, but we won't get deep in the trade weeds. Heidi, I wanted to ask you a question before we get to a few audience questions. And this one is about concentration, corporate concentration and antitrust. I know you referred to it a little bit and there's some stuff on the Biden website about it, but it hasn't really been a focus. It's obviously a concern. And Jared brought it up a little bit that we have seen more and more power concentrated in larger and larger companies dominating the economy. I just wonder how aggressive you think the Biden administration will be on antitrust and on increased corporate concentration. How big of a priority is that going to be?
That's a good question. I think they'll be pretty aggressive, but I also think that a Biden administration would think of it in a portfolio of things to help rebalance the economy. There's all sorts of things that are out of whack. I'm not somebody who thinks that just corporate concentration is the only issue that's going on. There's lots of things that sort of put workers at a disadvantage vis-a-vis their employers. And so it really would be a really important issue. It's getting a ton more attention, which is great. It's sort of a newly understood lever that can be pulled to help rebalance the economy, but it's still just one of many.
Mm. Jared, what about that? To what extent do you see like an aggressive antitrust stance from a Biden Justice Department?
It's definitely something that the team is talking about and that the candidate has raised. I know that Senator Harris has looked at these issues as well. I think one interesting point in this regard is if you, again, go over some of the policy proposals on the website, look at the bankruptcy one, for instance, which has...
Let me ask Congressman Beyer that same question. Do you think this is an issue the Biden administration should be aggressive about in terms of...
I very much hope so. I think that the incredible concentration of industry after industry has not been good for the American worker. It's made it a lot easier to pay people at the top a great deal of money and sort of flatten out all the wages for everyone else.
Yeah.
I think more Americans are employees as a percentage than at any time in American history. So I hope that they will do that.
Gotcha.
I also being able to move away from this notion of the maximization of shareholder value as the prime and only objective of corporations would be a really good thing. And that the Biden...
How do we go about doing that? How do we achieve that goal? Like, reducing the focus on increasing shareholder value versus stakeholders, other stakeholders.
It's been nice to see folks like the Business Roundtable actually talk about it is only one of many different objectives. The only really constructive thing I've seen, and although it's very bold, is Elizabeth Warren's idea of co-determination.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that you have to move to in a stepwise process.
Gotcha.
But to the extent that a corporate board also reflects the interests of its community and of the workers, that's good.
Right. Speaking of Elizabeth Warren, I wonder if we have Jared back on, ask him this too, and Heidi as well. Who do you like for attorney general in a Biden administration? Warren is a name that's been out there for that job as well as Treasury Secretary. But do you guys have any thoughts on who an aggressive AG might be for President Biden?
Nope.
Come on, throw some names out, please. Go.
Amy Klobuchar.
Okay. What about you, Jared?
This is the kind of leaning over your skis that gets you into trouble. I will not do so.
Gotcha. Okay. What about, I'm going to go on the same thing, and this is an audience question, which was who will be in Biden's cabinet. So now you have to actually tell me every member of the cabinet and just give us, you could post on the website the list of all candidates for all the top jobs.
I'll tweet it out as soon as we're done.
Don't tweet it. Just give it to me.
Okay. I see. Right.
The other thing, is a Treasury Secretary, Elizabeth Warren, which to a degree scares a lot of bankers, and maybe it should. To what extent do you expect her to play a role in this administration, or will she stay in the Senate? Obviously, a lot of my readers on Wall Street are interested in that question.
So I'm just going to say a couple things that don't really answer your question. First of all, and this is purely my prediction, so for what it's worth, this doesn't come from any information I've picked up anywhere, just other than being in the ether. I would bet you that the Biden cabinet is the most diverse or one of the most diverse, both gender and race, that has ever been seated. Two, I thought it was very interesting and important that both Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders, and Senator Warren very robustly endorsed Biden. And it wasn't just, to me, it didn't look like just, hey, you know, let's all get together and play act like we really, you know, because of the convention, that there was sincere endorsement, particularly. And last night, Senator Warren, you know, as I said before, my internet went out, her fingerprints and even some of her language are in a number of the proposals, particularly in the area of finance and bankruptcy. So those connections are very much there.
Got it. Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about, we've got some other questions from the audience. I'm going to ask a couple of those. And I think anybody can feel free to jump in on these if you have an answer. I asked you about Warren and Treasury. What would be the efforts by the Biden administration to really assist minority small businesses? These obviously groups that have been hit particularly hard by COVID-19 and not necessarily reached by the PPP program. What would Biden do specifically to help minority-owned small businesses? And anybody can grab this.
Well, thing is...
You go.
Go ahead, Jared.
No, you go, Don.
In the HEROES Act, which we passed now 3 months ago, when we renewed PPP, we did the first $75 billion specifically for small businesses, you know, 10 or less, and doing it through community organizations, the community banks. And I would hope that if that doesn't come to pass in the next couple of weeks, that's something Joe Biden will do.
Gotcha. Okay. Heidi, did you have a thought on that?
Nope.
Nope. Okay. Jared, did you want to weigh in?
Let me say that, first of all, if you're really interested in this, you really should read the racial equity proposal that came out a couple of weeks ago, because there are many ideas quite specific in this space. For example, there's a spurring more than $500 billion in public-private ventures that focus on Black and brown entrepreneurs. Part of this comes through expanding the New Market Tax Credit. There's $100 billion in low-interest loans to communities of color, including tribal communities. This is through community development financial institutions, kind of local minority, often minority-run depository institutions from the Community Reinvestment Act, and a very significant expansion of an initiative that not too many people know about. It's from the Obama-Biden administration called the SSBCI, which is the State Small Business Credit Initiative, which provides venture capital to Black and brown people. And that is one area that we don't talk enough about in discussing racial disparities. Mm-hmm. The extent of venture capital that finds its way to Black and brown entrepreneurs is just shamefully minuscule. And a Biden administration would attack that.
Yeah, we just got a couple of minutes left. I want to ask each of you about the Federal Reserve. Jay Powell's term goes until 2022. One would presume that President Biden would want somebody new at the Fed. Do you think he should replace Powell and would replace Powell and perhaps bring Janet Yellen back or someone else? And anybody can jump on that one.
I love Janet Yellen, but my inclination would be to encourage President Biden to keep Jay Powell. I think he's done a very good job. He's shown his independence from the president and the Congress, which I think we very much appreciate, and a Fed chair.
Yeah, he certainly has done that, not always to his Twitter joy waking up in the morning, although obviously the president is less vocal about that now that we've slashed rates back down again. Jared, what do you think? Keep Powell or move on to somebody else?
Yeah, I don't really have a call on that. I mean, I think Heidi Sherholtz would be awesome. But
there you go. She's,
I will just second Don's point. I'm hard pressed to find all the positive adjectives I can think of for Jay Powell's job. I mean, pre-crisis in particular, almost in every talk, Powell was talking about something that's near and dear to my own heart and to Heidi's as well. The idea that monetary policy should be driven by data, not by these fuzzy notions of a natural rate of unemployment that we really can't estimate reliably enough to make it a policy guidepost. And Powell was consistently talking about how much persistently tight, really tight labor markets were lifting folks who've been traditionally left behind, particularly persons in communities of color.
Got it. Heidi, you might let the last word go to you. And I want to ask you, you know, let's presume Biden wins and he takes office with an unemployment rate still somewhere close to 10%, maybe 9%. We just don't know exactly what direction it's going to move. As Jared pointed out, pace of job creation has slowed. We've only replaced something like 9 million of the 22 million we lost. How quickly can a Joe Biden administration turn this thing around, get the unemployment rate down? Like, how low could he get it in year one? And what will be the biggest thing he does to make that happen?
The biggest obstacle he'll face and that the economy is facing is a lack of aggregate demand. And it really, like we talked about the Fed, the Fed is doing as much as they can, but it really will come down to Congress passing major fiscal stimulus. So it will be a matter of how much do we have a Senate that will pass major fiscal stimulus that will help fill in the aggregate demand back and get us on the road to recovery? That will be the thing that determines how fast growth is in his first year as president.
Gotcha. And I'm just Jared and Don, if you want to weigh in very quickly, the extent to which you think Biden is going to face a Republican Senate that all of a sudden won't want to spend any more money and will sort of claim its fiscal austere roots. Like, how big of an issue is that going to be for Biden if he's got a GOP Senate? Just real quick.
We do know the Republicans care about the deficit when they're not in power. But we're hoping that, I would just assume that the Republicans were not in power in the Senate, that we had Chuck Schumer as majority leader, and that they cared more than they do right now.
Gotcha. And Jared, what does Biden do if he's got to deal with
the Republicans? Yeah, I can summarize my views on that pretty quickly, I think. Number one, if Republicans hold the Senate, there's a lot in the Biden agenda that I know for a fact Republicans, not every one of them, but Republicans like and support, like infrastructure investment. And Biden has a long history of reaching across the aisle and finding cooperation where other folks haven't. But if the Democrats have a Senate majority, we all need to take out our reconciliation handbooks and learn everything we can in there.
Gotcha. And Jared, how low can he get the unemployment rate by the end of his first year in office?
We're probably talking percentage points with an S.
Gotcha. Okay. So, 5%, something like that, 6%.
In year one?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd rather talk about deltas than levels because I just don't know where we'll be.
Gotcha. That's a fair point.
All right. That's our show. I'm Ben White. My thanks to Congressman Don Beyer, Jared Bernstein, and Heidi Shierholz for joining me. Our producer is Nirmal Malaikal. Jenny Ament is our senior producer, and Irene Noguchi is our executive producer. Subscribe to Politico Money wherever you're listening. You can follow Politico's coverage of the coronavirus in our Politico nightly newsletter and in Morning Money. And don't forget to tune in next week for our panel with economic advisors from President Trump's administration during the Republican National Convention. Thanks so much for listening, and stay safe out there.